filled in a little bit. I know we have a lot of folks sick. I have a list on my desk, and it's not even complete, that I've been praying for. And when I find out somebody else is sick or COVID, I write it on that list, and I've been praying for them. And I know you are as well. I'm proud of you as a church family. So we're looking forward to when we have a church family reunion. What that is, when everybody's well and back together. I was thinking about family reunion because that's what we'll be talking about today in our passage. And I think about families. We had our first family reunion as the Harkle Roads. I think back in 98, we became dorm parents. So in the summer, we had this large dorm that would house 60 guys. So we said, hey, we could house the Harkle Road family. So we crammed them in. There was more of them than there were guys in the dorm typically. And it was a great time. And we just knew that God was moving, and we could feel the Spirit of God. We had an impromptu kind of devotional time and sharing time in one of the lounges at the dorm, and it was just powerful. Family reunions are powerful. And I know that family connections are powerful. You know, when Pam and I got married in 1980, we lived in Ohio, and we lived there about a year and a half, and I found that we more and more frequently would come back to this area, about three and a half hour drive, because I just really loved her family. So finally, in August of 81, we moved to Fountain County. We lived down by Kingman for 10 years and 3 days. Then we moved here to Covington. And it's family. The connection of family is so strong and powerful. And we don't want to take it for granted. And so Max, my father-in-law, many of you have known him or met him. He passed in 92. Besides my bride, he was my best friend. I just loved being with him. We spent almost every day together. We'd go to breakfast every day together. Sometimes he'd come help me on a project as I was a builder, or sometimes I'd go make a hospital call with him, and I learned a lot from Max. One thing I learned from him is how to love people as a shepherd. He just never stopped loving on people. So family makes a difference. Today we're going to talk about this family reunion. We're going to see it in Exodus 18, if you want to turn there. So far, Israel has been complaining. That's what we're learning here. They cried out to God in the first chapter of Exodus, but then it seems like ever since then, they just had these moments of complaint, except for take pause in chapter 15. They had a moment of celebration and song. And Warren Wiersbe says, praising God is better than complaining to God. And I would agree. But I find that too often we default to complaining. So life isn't just like I want it. It's got these challenges and bumps and bruises. So then we finally have these blessings that come from God. I shouldn't say finally. We get blessings from God all the time. But we finally recognize a blessing from God. And look what Charles Spurgeon says. God's people are prone to engrave their trials in marble and write their blessings in the sand. Isn't that true? We are prone to just make much out of all these trials, and they seem to make a bigger impression on us than the goodness of God and the blessings of God. And as we talk through this today, as we unpack this, I think it's going to be good for us to retrain our minds. Retrain our tongues to speak of the blessings of God. Let's read six verses here in Exodus 18. And Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons, of whom the names of one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. And the name of the other was Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, must have been another Jethro, because he keeps repeating Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Now he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law, Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and her two sons with her. You know, who told Jethro? Because that first verse says, and Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and Israel, his people. Who told him? Likely, Moses sent a messenger back, but it doesn't say that. Either way, these were such big events that it could have just been in the daily news. And they didn't have TV, but it was probably heralded all through the Middle East. Like, they were free from that. All the plagues that hit Egypt and the Red Sea parted. Who knows? But likely, Moses said, man, I miss my wife and kids. I'm going to send somebody back to them and tell them what's going on and where we're at, and maybe we can reacquaint. So I thought about our lives and our journey to date, and I want you to think about your journey to date. See, when we read a lot of the Old Testament, we are reading true history. We're reading true history, and we don't want to keep it just in the history mode. The history has lessons for us to learn and for us to engage with. And I don't know how many times I'm reading the scripture and think, what would it be like if I was in their shoes? Well, you are in their shoes, but you're in your own shoes here. But you're experiencing life like they've experienced life. And so in your experiences of life, you have a journey to date so far. And it doesn't matter if you're still in high school or if you're retired or if you're in the middle of a career. Or if you're in the noisery, you have a journey to date so far. And everybody's journey looks different. Everybody's journey of faith looks different. Here, Moses was separated from his wife and kids for a little while because the task was so huge. And that'd be hard enough. I've been married 41 plus years, and I've only been away from my bride 20 nights. I'd be a mess without her. But God didn't call me to a time like Moses had, at least not yet. He may someday. He may say, I have something different for you, Andy, and it's going to require you to be separated from your wife for a short time. I don't know, but God writes your story, and he has you on this journey. Moses spent half his life in the desert. Just as a review, he was 40 years old, and he killed that Egyptian, and then he ran for the hills. And he ended up in Midian, and half his life he spent preparing at this point. So he's 80 years old when he has this God encounter at the burning bush. And the first 40 years of his life, he was trained in the schools of Pharaoh, if you may. He was Pharaoh's like grandson because Pharaoh's daughter adopted him, embraced him, and took him in. So he learned all of Egypt's ways. But in this side of the desert, backside of the desert, for 40 years, he's learning a lot about life in the desert. He's learning how to shepherd. He was actually taking care of Jethro, his father-in-law, his sheep. He was taking care of them when he had that burning bush experience. He was a shepherd, and he was learning about what life was like to be a shepherd. God likely had him there for 40 years. He was collecting and being saturated with Egyptian philosophy. And Egyptian philosophy had all kinds of false gods, all kinds of other gods, and it was not the God of the Hebrews, and it was not the God of the Bible. So for 40 years, he got saturated or marinated in that culture. The next 40 years, I believe God was pulling that out of him and teaching him something different, although I don't think that it was a perfect setting in Midian. Later in the desert, he'll spend another 40 years leading Israel. So his life is chunked in 40s, 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in Midian as he's Jethro's son-in-law, and then 40 years he leads Israel. And that is God's journey in his life. And it looks different than my life. I won't live to be 120 for starters, but it looks different. Sometimes, though, in our own life circumstances, they feel long and worthless. You ever felt like that? Have you ever been through this kind of like desert time in your life and you're like, we have to get out of this time. This time is wearing me out and it's worthless. We got to get back to life. COVID can kind of feel like that. How many people have I heard that says, we got to get on with living again? And we just feel like we're in this pause moment, but we're not in a pause moment. We are in a real living time right now. COVID is real and it became part of our life. Just like 9/11, when it happened, our lives changed and it's never gone back to the way it was before. And our lives will likely never again be like it was pre-COVID. So start living today. Don't wait to live when it gets back to where you want it to be. Sometimes these circumstances just feel long and worthless, but I will tell you that God is teaching us things. It's interesting in this passage, Moses named his kids with his journey in mind. He says, one he called Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. Can you imagine naming your kid a whole sentence? I've been a stranger in a foreign land. I wonder if they abbreviated and call him Stranger. Hey, Stranger, time for dinner. And his friends on the playground said, hey, Strange. I can only imagine. And the other he named Eleazar, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. That is a longer name to call to dinner. Woo. Our kids, I'll just say it out loud. Ethan and Cody Lee named their kids full sentences. Mark, James, Joseph, Andrew, Harker Road. And then they got another one that is Anali Ahava Harkel Road. That means answer me with love. Anali Ahava Harkel Road. That's a mouthful. It's real close to that. So they abbreviate. It's Anya, or it's MJ, or it's Owen, not Owen Joseph Andrew Harkel Road. We're blessed. Blessed with good grandkids. His journey had such an impact that he actually named his kids that. But here he is at the mountain of God, it says, encamped in verse 5. At the bottom of that, he says he was encamped at the mountain of God. And I want to remind you that what I said something not too long ago, that in in chapter 3, verse 12, at the burning bush, God says, I will give you a sign. You will come again. You will bring them here again, to where this burning bush is, to the Mount Horeb, and you will worship me here. And that's where he's at. He went full circle. We don't know how long it took when they were in Egypt and the plagues were pouring out. I really believe it took a long time. They went through different harvest seasons, and there had to be time to recover from some of the plagues for the next plague to kill all the cattle again. Well, they lost all the cattle back here, so they had to have time to get new cattle. So I really believe that the plagues were not like just in a 3 or 4 week period. I believe they might have taken even a year. I have no idea. Don't write that down. But it took a long time, but he did finally make it back to Horeb, the mountain of God, like God promised him. Can you reflect back on your life and see how God used certain things to prepare you for today? I don't mean for this morning service, but I mean for what you're doing in life right now. I think it's good to just pause sometimes and reflect. Can you reflect on something God used in your life to prepare you for this? You know, I went to school when I was 35 to be a pastor. And I kept telling God no because I cannot speak in front of people. Three's the limit. I ain't doing it. He said, sit down. And so I really thought then I'll go through 4 years of Bible college and end up in the pastorate. And then even that made me nervous. So little did I see something coming. He actually had the school hire me to work in their facilities department. And while I was doing that, they asked me to teach a class. And in the teaching of that class, it helped me learn to be able to communicate with more than three people. I never saw that coming, so I taught for 7 years, 14 semesters. And I loved my students. Some of them come to this church. My daughter-in-law, Ashley Nearman, who plays the piano, they were students. And I was freaked out teaching in front of people. But I believe God used that to prepare me. A lot of times we think about trials. Okay, God put me through the woodshed, and then I learned and prepared me for life. But think about the positive things that God used in your life to prepare you for the things you're doing now. So the things I never saw coming, and God just interrupts my life and says, okay, and he's interrupted your life, and here's what we do. We miss it. We don't realize it's preparation for something. No matter what it is, it's preparation for something. And God, on purpose, allows these events in your life, these pauses in your life, and it's prepared you for today and forward. Today and forward. Here's the deal. Others are watching your journey of faith, my journey of faith. They're watching, and you think, no, I feel pretty inconspicuous, and I do that on purpose. I want to be inconspicuous. But we are making a statement with our daily lives in what we believe about God. Every decision you make is what you believe about God. So our testimony, our journey to date, is being observed by many, even when we don't recognize it. Let's pick up and read in verse 7 to verse 12. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him, and they asked each other about their well-being. And they went into the tent, and Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. Then Jethro rejoiced for all the good which the Lord had done for Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them." Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. I think probably more than any other phrase in this whole 12-verse passage is father-in-law. So that's why I couldn't quit thinking about my father-in-law, Max. He was an awesome father-in-law. Who's the hero in your story? It's not the father-in-law. As much as I love my father-in-law and as much as I think he did a lot of great things, some of you in this room, he probably bent the knee with and prayed with. Max Paddock prayed with you, and some of you even to the point of salvation. Who's the hero in your story? You know, there's all kinds of famous people. It's amazing to watch people clamor to be next to a famous person. They think somehow it's going to make them better. It gives them affirmation or validation. I don't know what. But they are just people like we are. Moses was just like we are. You cut him, he bleeds just like we bleed. Stomp on his toe, it hurts just like ours does. Has emotions just like we do. He was a person just like we are. In James 5:17, it says, Elijah was a man subject to like passions as we are. And he prayed earnestly that it might not rain. You remember that verse? So Elijah, it says, was a man just like we are. He was a person just like we are. He got hungry like we get hungry. He got tired like we get tired. He got impatient like we get impatient. Elijah, Moses, it doesn't matter who it is. We'll get to see these fellows in heaven, and they are just like we are. Sometimes we look at these Old Testament saints or even New Testament saints and think, they were different. I could never aspire unto that because I'm not like that. There's only one reason we wouldn't be like that. We're not living in the Spirit. If we live in the Spirit, they have nothing on us. Because there's a verse that's true for them and it's true for us. Without me, you can do nothing. John 15:5. He says, without me, you can do nothing. So they, without God, could do nothing. We, without God, can do nothing. So heroes, they had the same struggles in life. And they, these heroes that we're looking at, whether it's Moses or Elijah, what they had is they would shine light back on Jesus. They realized we're not the sun, we're the moon, we just reflect. And we need to just reflect God's glory. We do not clamor for the glory. Your personal testimony is one of your greatest tools for sharing your faith and God's faithfulness. God's the hero, and so your testimony is really declaring, should declare, what has God done in my life, and what is God doing through my life? It's about God. It's not about me and what I've done. But we can quickly forget God's personal rescue. We can forfeit lots of opportunities to brag on him. We are prone to minimize God's rescue in our life. I want us to just slow down and think about that for a minute. We are prone to minimize God's rescue in our life. Why is it that when we first get saved, we are thrilled, and then after we've been saved for a while, it's like, yeah, I'm a Christian. Yeah, cool. Posture changes, everything. Yeah, I don't have to go to hell. That's cool. No, he rescued us, and there's some reasons why. How have we minimized, right? When we minimize our depravity and our desperation. Think about that for a minute. When we stop realizing just how bad we were or are, just how desperate we are for a Savior, when we stop thinking about what God rescued us from, we've minimized God's rescue in our life. When we take the credit for things getting better. So think about that. You're going through life and all of a sudden you were on hard times and then things got better, and you take that opportunity to say, yeah, I did this or I did that or I went to school. I made something out of my life. I started a business. I did that. Whatever it is, when we take the credit, we've minimized God's rescue in our life. When we spend more time talking about our accomplishments or declaring our goodness, we've missed the opportunities to declare the rescue of God. You know, the people that are so enjoyable to be with, I'll give you a clue. They're the ones that aren't talking about themselves. They're either really good listeners to what you have to say, or they're really good braggers on who God is. That's the people that are so enjoyable to bask in their fellowship. Worship is a natural response. Worship is a natural response. Jethro had some natural responses, and I thought it was really interesting. In verse 9, Jethro rejoiced. In verse 10, Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord God who delivered you out of the land, out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and who has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." Verse 11, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods." Verse 12, "Then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and other sacrifices to offer to God." He rejoiced, and I really believe that rejoicing was an inward rejoicing. So Moses' testimony, you remember a few points back I said our testimony is making a difference. Moses' testimony of God's faithfulness caused his father-in-law to rejoice, and others with him, I'm sure, inwardly. Like there's just a joy, an inner joy, in like an internal celebration of God. He spoke out loud then, so what was inside then came outside. And it says he blessed the Lord. You know, I think about Psalm 34 when I read that. Psalm 34, verse 1, I don't know, maybe three or four verses here. It says, "I will bless the Lord at all times. even when I have COVID, even when I'm in the hospital, even when I'm broke, even when I'm divorced, even when I'm hurt, even when I lose my job, even when things aren't going well, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise will continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord, and the humble will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Come, let us exalt his name together. Why? I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and he delivered me from all my fears. Think about Moses. I don't think Moses wrote that psalm, but I bet you Moses would echo that psalm. He will bless the Lord at all times. Let that be our mantra. So he gives perspective on who God is, and I thought this was interesting. In verse 11, he says, Jethro says, "Now I know the Lord is greater than all gods." You know what we do? We take these Old Testament saints and we think, Jethro must have just been one godly guy. I mean, Moses is meandering around in the Midian wilderness, and he bumps into the seven daughters of Jethro at the well, and other shepherds were beating up on them or being punks and took their water and wouldn't let them water their sheep. So Moses is intercedes, and he kicks those guys out of the way, and he waters their sheep, and he goes home, and he meets Jethro. Jethro's like, "Marry my daughter." And we think, what a godly match. We don't know that. I think about Jacob's wife. When he left Laban with Rachel and Leah, his two wives, when he left, Rachel, his favorite, hid the idols of her dad in the camel's furniture, it said. She stole them. She stole the family idols. These people were not necessarily godly to start with. And I don't know that when he says, "Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods." You know, the Midians were from the line of Abraham, but it wasn't with Sarah. It was later after Sarah passed and he married Keturah. And he had, I don't know how many, six or seven other kids. And one of them was Midian. And so it is a descendant of Midian, or of Abraham. But for him to say, "Now I know," gives me the idea that he might have been a priest, but other gods had priests as well. And I believe that there's a good chance that Jethro wasn't necessarily a sold out God Yahweh follower. And then he became acquainted with Yahweh through Moses' testimony. And I'm not convinced that Moses was a godly Yahweh follower. I think he knew about the Hebrew God from whatever took place back in that short time that he was with his mom and dad. And I believe then that encounter at the burning bush is when he said, "This is now Lord of my life." I don't know. I don't want to put words in scripture, but we got to be really careful not to think these people were born saved. They had journeys of life and faith like we do, and they had to have a moment in their life when they surrendered to God, just like we do. But for the language for that to say, "Now I know." You know, I did some studying on this priest of Midian, and some of my studies, it's interesting. Most commentaries gave me about this much in a paragraph to say about these 12 verses. And they really didn't talk much about these 12 verses in any paragraphs that I, or any commentaries that I read. And I thought, I can't just zoom past this. I see worship written all over this. I see worship written all over this passage. I see a testimony of Moses, which is worship, and then I see how it changed a life that is in Jethro. But when I was looking up about Jethro all the way back from chapter 3 or 2, whenever he met Jethro's family, it says there's a chance was when they call a priest, he could have been a leader. So either way, he was a spiritual leader or a country leader in Midian. But I'm not convinced that God the Creator was their God. And for this language to say, "Now I know," I believe this was a life-turning event. and a life-turning moment in Jethro's life. And our life, like Moses' life, when we share our testimonies of God's goodness, then it can be a life-turning event in other people's lives. In a little bit, Devin Fry is going to be baptized, and she's going to tell you about a life-turning time in her life. And as you hear it, it can make a difference in your life. What is worship? Let's cover this just briefly. Worship is more than a Sunday morning together. It's a life. It's an attitude. It's a spirit of worship. And I think we have been mistaken for so long to think that worship is the hour and a half that we spend here on Sunday mornings. And it is not. The Greek word for worship, proskuneo, is to fall down before or to bow down before. And when I reflect on the very meaning of worship, I don't know that we do it well all the time. It is saying you are greater than, you are worthy. I have some of those here. I'll just start mashing the button. Recognition of who God is. That is worship. Recognizing who he is. Not who you want him to be. Not who you think he is, but who is he really? Who is the Bible say he is? Giving him the credit for what he's done. Not taking the credit. Declaring he is worthy. It is creation living out his intended purpose. What do I mean by that? All through the Bible, we read about the stars worship. The rocks will cry out. And all that kind of thing. And I'm going to put a psalm up in here in a minute. You'll see in a few verses what that, how that postures it. But when creation is doing exactly what God intended it to do, it is worship. Watch these verses. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. I have never heard a star speak. I've never heard a rock speak. But their voice has something to say about God. What does that mean? Their very existence doing what God intended when he created them is worship. And when we do what God created us to do, it is worship. So worship is more than coming here on Sunday mornings and singing and standing and sitting and praying. Yes, that's worship. It's called corporate worship. But worship is when we go to work. Worship is when we're driving down the road and we're talking to the Lord and acknowledging who he is. Worship is in everything we do that is holy. And don't overstretch what it means to be holy. It just means to be right with God, doing the next right thing. Doing the next right thing. And that is worship. Here's what happens. Worship spills out of the overflow of our heart. And I believe that was true in Jethro's case. His father-in-law, remember that? I believe that was true in Jethro's case. It says he rejoiced and then he spoke. And we can't worship if we have no overflow. Worship comes from the overflow of our heart. It could be overflow of joy, but it could be overflow of grief. And what spills out of us from the cup into the saucer, onto the table, it spills out of us and worship comes out of that. That is where the worship comes from. We will overflow when we are overflowing with him. Let me wrap this up. Let me just kind of give us some takeaways. How's that? Is your testimony making a difference? Let's just make this personal. Is your testimony making a difference? Is God central in your conversation? I think that's a fair question. Is God central in your conversation? Or does he only show up on Sunday mornings in your conversation? What's your message? What is your message? These are all personal questions, rhetorical, that you have to answer inwardly. Are you seeking for personal glory or even validation? Is that what's driving us? I will tell you that the moon was designed to reflect the sun, but every once in a while we have an eclipse, and the moon gets between Earth and the sun. Are we doing that with God? Are we creating a lunar eclipse to where we're eclipsing God by declaring our own glory because we want validation? I want people to think of me thus and so. I want to be recognized. I need to be noticed. Is that what drives our train? I don't think God had that intended. Is your testimony making a difference? I believe it is. I should say, is your testimony making a positive difference? Is your God making a difference? First of all, is it the God of the Bible? I'm going to say yes. God is making a difference. We just have to slow down and recognize what he's doing. Slow down and recognize what he's doing. Here's where I started earlier in the beginning. We need to train our hearts to be thankful. Some people just are naturally thankful people. It just spills out of them all the time. But if it's not the case with you, train your heart to be thankful. Train our minds to look for opportunities to share. You're in a grocery store, you're at a restaurant, you're somewhere, you're at work. Look for opportunities. Train yourself to look for opportunities to share the goodness of God. Train our tongues to proclaim, not to complain. Can I say that again? Because that's been Israel's problem all along. Train our tongues to proclaim, not to complain. Proclaim the goodness of God, not to complain about our dire straits or our mild inconveniences, I should say. Another one. Is your life making a difference? I thought about this week. What will your obituary say? Don't you wish somebody would write your obituary now and then you'd have a chance to edit your life? Not edit your obituary. Edit your life. You know, that's what happened to, I lost his name. He created gunpowder. And his brother died. And they thought for sure, it was Alfred Noble. And they thought for sure, they had the names mixed up in the obituary. And it says the creator of death or the master of death died. And they went on and talked about him, Ludwig. His brother was the one that died, not Alfred. So he had a chance. He had 9 more years. He realized, this is what the world thinks of me. I cause death. I cause problems. So hence, Alfred Nobel, they went on and they have the Nobel Peace Prizes now because he spent the next 9 years changing things to edit his life so that his obituary wouldn't read what it would have read 9 years prior. We have a chance to edit our life. I didn't rehearse that. I forgot about that illustration till just now, so I probably boogered it. But we have a chance to edit our life right now and make a difference for Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says we are ambassadors for Christ. And he goes on and he says in that verse, so therefore he's compelling people to reconcile with God. Is that what you want for people, or do you just want them to validate you? I have to ask myself the same question. Do I want validation, or do I want them to be validated by God? What's my message? What's my message? Let's put this up here one more time. God's people are prone to engrave their trials in marble and write their blessings in the sand. As we find this to be true, let's learn from our trials and make much of God for his blessings. So trials has their place. Let's learn from them. Don't don't just push them aside. They have value. Learn from them, but make much of God and his blessings. Let me pray with you. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for being the God who you are. And Lord, I don't know that we do so well worshiping. We worship on occasion. May it be who we are all the time. May we just exude worship all the time, every opportunity we can find. Thank you, Lord, for your goodness. Amen. Okay, Devin. Our worship team's coming back. We will prepare for a baptism.